We lock up a lot of people in this country. More than 2 million people make up the prison and jail population. That's men and women total. That's a lot of people, and they're not all in there for life. But getting on with life when they get out can be tricky, especially since many employers are reluctant to hire people with criminal records. That's why nearly half the states, including Oregon and California, have passed laws to ban the box, to remove the box asking about criminal convictions from job applications. Our guest this hour is a big believer in hiring people who serve time in the criminal justice system. Jeffrey Korzenek is the author of Untapped Talent: How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. Jeff Korzenek works for Fifth Third. It's a tough name to explain, but it's a very large bank, as chief investment strategist. He speaks and writes often on second chance hiring and makes frequent media appearances like this one to make the case. Jeffrey Korzenek, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here with you and your listeners.
It is good to have you. Talk about your own interest and why you've made this such a focus of your work.
You know, it started out for purely professional reasons. Back around 2013, 2014, a big discussion among people who followed the markets and the economy, which is my professional role, was why we were missing so many people from the labor force. And this was something that was already holding back growth. And I started to hear from companies we bank, many of them in manufacturing and transportation and other aspects of logistics, that they couldn't find people who could pass a drug test, and they needed that for workplace safety. So that was my first entree into how social ills had become so large in the United States that they became a problem for economic growth. And it's a pretty easy step from the drug epidemic to the incarceration recidivism problem we have in the United States. We lock up too many people, and they have very, very bad outcomes once they come home. At the same time, a few years later, around 2015, I frankly, by accident, stumbled into an employer or two who had made it a practice to seek out people with criminal records and to give them gainful employment, and they had developed models that worked. And since that time, I've taken upon myself to share those models with the business community.
It sounds like a bit of a revelation coming across those employers and their systems for bringing people in from incarceration.
It is. And what was remarkable to me is that these employers are, first of all, hard to find. You have to do it through word of mouth and searching them out. But they worked in different industries, in different geographies. For the most part, they didn't know each other. And yet they had all come up through trial and error to the same set of solutions. And that was the evidence I needed that this was a model that could be replicated and scaled across the United States.
Your first words in the book are to people currently incarcerated to give them words of encouragement. This is not an easy situation they're in. It sounds like a lot of them really do struggle for quite some time to find gainful employment.
Yes, that was important. The audience of the book is a broad audience, obviously business decision makers, the general public. But I also thought it was important to write to people who were currently incarcerated. I've met so many people and have many friends who were formerly incarcerated who told me that when they went in at age 18, 19, 20, they thought their life was over. And I really believe that no young person should feel their life is over at age 18. So I wanted people who are currently incarcerated to know that there are people who value them and that they have a future, although the road is hard. There's a generous philanthropist outside of Philadelphia who's actually funded sending 500 of these books so far to prison libraries around the United States, because this message needs to be told to people who are currently in the system.
And on the other end of the transaction, I mean, what kind of responses do you often get upon first broaching this subject? Is it some variation of, oh my goodness, no, we would never consider hiring those people?
Well, there's been a sea change in that. It's quite interesting. Now that the labor shortage, which my research had pointed to for several years and which is the subject of the early chapters of the book, this labor shortage that won't go away, now that it's upon us, there's more receptivity. But I also get a lot of response from business owners who tell me, I've tried it, it didn't work. And the reality is that there are ways to do this, many ways to do this wrong, and really only one path for doing it right. And so the challenge today is businesses that are starting to consider this need to do it the right way. Businesses that have done it the wrong way need to be shown that the problem was not the people, but their process.
So I want to come back to the what you're talking about, the labor shortage that won't go away, a permanent shortage of labor we're talking about here. So there's no quick recovery from the big quit we've seen of late?
Correct. And in fact, this is something that I had expected prior to the pandemic to happen gradually. The pandemic brought a lot of this forward. The biggest issue, the backdrop has always been that we simply stopped having enough babies decades ago to grow our workforce. And workforce growth is an absolutely key component of overall economic growth. And we had expected prior to the pandemic about 10,000 baby boomers a day to leave the workforce. And now that we have the millennials more or less all in, there just weren't enough workers to compensate for the loss of the baby boomers. What happened during the pandemic is that many baby boomers accelerated their retirement. The St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank came out with an estimate that 2.4 million workers retired early during the pandemic. That's something that is really plaguing the business community today.
And I can see where, 2.4 million people vanishing from the workforce rather suddenly does not get replaced by another group of people suddenly.
That's correct. And the reality is, again, when you start to look at people who are of the age to enter the workforce, there's just not enough of them. And we are at levels where our rate of fertility, the number of children that women will have over their lifetime, is so low we can't even make up for this with undercurrent immigration laws. So the answer has to be, for the business community, dig deeper into the population and make sure that we are not overlooking any opportunity for talent.
All right, there is the sketch. We will start adding detail as we head further into the conversation with Jeffrey Korzenek, the author of Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. We're talking about second chances for people who've been in the criminal justice system. We'll come back and pick up the conversation with Jeff, and you can join the conversation when we return in a minute 10. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We are talking about the idea of hiring people who have spent time in the criminal justice system, which is daunting to some employers, plain and simple, but becoming more attractive over time as the workforce seems to shrink in America relative to the overall population. Jeffrey Korzenek, who works as an investment strategist for a very large bank, has written about this extensively in his book, Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. You're more than welcome to get into the conversation, ask your questions, talk about experiences you might have had on one end of the transaction or the other at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. To a very basic set of issues about the economy, Jeffrey, I want to pick up on talking about where we stand relative to economic growth in history. You're not the first guest to talk about the fact that this is not like the post-war period, and probably won't ever really be like that, will it?
It won't unless we change our workforce and fertility practices or potentially immigration. Growth potential for any economy essentially boils down to two factors. How fast can you grow your workforce, and how fast can you grow their productivity? And while there are things you can do to enhance productivity, invest in technology, for example, it historically has its limits. So productivity can help, But our workforce growth right now is so low that it is, according to estimates, for instance, from the Congressional Budget Office, it has reduced U.S. potential growth over time to an annual growth rate of 1.7%. That's a far cry from the 3 or 4% growth rate that many of us enjoyed since World War II. And when you compound that, it's an even more serious issue.
This is actually fairly simple math. It's, I mean, it's obviously big numbers, but you're multiplying the numbers of people available to work times the productivity, and you're getting a limit on growth based on that.
That's exactly right. And it is something that doesn't have to be as bad as it is. We can reach deeper into various parts of our population, and that includes making accommodations for working parents, using people, the uniquely abled people who have challenges that or abilities that are different from the rest of us, neurodiverse populations, for instance. But the big win, just on the numbers, is looking at the tens of millions of people who are either unemployed or underemployed because of a criminal record.
So, you know, I guess we shouldn't be surprised by the criminal justice impact on the labor force, but you say that magnitude is shocking. What makes it shocking?
Well, if you start with our labor force today, payrolls are about, call it 150 million. We have 19 million people in the United States with felony convictions, tens of millions more. It's been estimated about 70 plus million who have some kind of interaction with the justice system, felonies, misdemeanors, even things where you can be arrested and have charges dropped or found not guilty, that can still be an impediment to full employment. And by full employment, I mean being able to participate to the full extent of your capability, being able to switch jobs to higher paid roles, being able to get professional licensing across different fields that you may be qualified for. Criminal records get in the way of all of this.
Yeah, that was a real oh yeah moment for me in the book, realizing that it's not just the 2+ million currently in lockup, but all the people who have gone through and come out the other side. And as you point out, now we're talking in the tens of millions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something we simply can't, from a business perspective, let others make the ethical case, but I am deeply invested in them, of course. But from a business standpoint, you simply can't afford to overlook talent no matter where it's found.
So what kinds of barriers do potential employers set up just to say nope to people with records?
There are some hard barriers that are in regulatory barriers, things like professional licensing. So in some states, if you have a felony conviction, no matter what it was, and many felony convictions are actually fairly minor transgressions. We have a long history of overcharging people in this country, but people with felony convictions and sometimes even misdemeanors may not be eligible for professional licenses like being able to be a barber in some states. So you have hard regulatory barriers. But more typical are barriers that are set up perhaps unwittingly within hiring firms. And there's typically a process for reviewing a criminal record, and it doesn't matter if you're in the ban-the-box state or not in the ban-the-box state. A criminal record is going to be reviewed typically within an HR function. And the problem is that career incentives for people in HR are not aligned to have them take what they would perceive as risks. So if you hire someone with a criminal record and they turn out to be a good hire, well, your job is to do good hires. If something goes wrong, particularly something that could be traced back to the criminal record, then your job is on the line. So you have these review processes that don't truly give a fair opportunity to people with criminal records. They may check the boxes in terms of EEOC requirements, for instance, but the answer always seems to be no. And then there are companies that have communicated essentially outright bans. We don't do that. We don't go there. That's the kind of language you hear, no matter what the law says.
Jeffrey Korzenek is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. Has the Ban the Box legislation, at my count, it was about 21 or 22 states, including all three West Coast states, have that in effect? Does it make much of a difference in the places where it's in effect?
It really has not. And in fact, there's some evidence in certain instances that it has actually made situations worse, that employers who are dead set against hiring people with criminal records tend to avoid whole populations and whole communities because they think they may end up liking someone who has a criminal record. When they get the record, they've wasted, you know, they want to deny that employment, and they've wasted all this time. So it seems to have had very little positive effect. It also has two follow-on negatives. One is it's become this silver bullet in the eyes of some that, oh, the problem is fixed. You know, we passed Ban the Box, no problem anymore. And that's far from the truth. So it doesn't really get us to address the issues. And then the other problem is more subtle. One of the things that I'm adamant about, employers have to do this with intention and having their eyes wide open, knowing what they're getting into. And that means they not only need a process for hiring people who are ready but they meet and good fits, but they also need to make sure that they have accommodations built in so that those employees can thrive. Just to give you a quick sense of one of those, people coming out of prison typically, or who've recently been convicted of a felony but don't have to go to prison, have to meet with a parole or probation officer. Well, those are usually meetings during the week, the work week. So you need to provide flex time and accommodations. People who are under community supervision, like parole or probation, may not be able to cross state lines, so they can't go to another job site if it's that kind of job. So what happens with Ban the Box is it encourages, I like the person, let's give it a whirl. And all too often, because the employer has not gone in this really understanding the issues, that employee doesn't work out. And the common response of employers who have a category of employees that don't work out is to say, let's not do that again. And that's been another issue, although an indirect issue, I think, with Ban the Box.
All right. So the employers certainly need to go into this, as you point out, eyes wide open, but understanding that there are some accommodations they may have to make. But and likewise, employees then also have to be completely honest about their needs to keep up with what their responsibilities are.
That's true. But unfortunately, the fact of that matter is many people who have justice involvement come from communities that don't have a lot of mentorship and coaching and the kind of social capital that we take for granted. How do we know how to communicate with a supervisor and advocate for ourselves? Many employees with criminal records simply don't have the experience or a mentor that can help them navigate that. So employers have to meet people where they are and set up systems. Sometimes this is just educated supervisors. So there's a manufacturing company based in Michigan that offers its supervisors the opportunity to go through a poverty simulation. Or sometimes there's a firm in California that has a psychologist on staff that helps coach employees. So there's all these systems that are really investments in your workforce that can be highly productive investments, but you need to know that you have to make them.
Jeffrey Korzenek is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, making the business case for hiring people who have done time in the criminal justice system. His book is Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. It's a conversation you are more than welcome to take part in. You may have some thoughts about the issues on either side of the transaction, from the side of the person seeking to get hired and the person seeking to hire. 800-838-3760 for questions or comments by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about some of the companies that do this. You profile I Have a Bean. It's a coffee company. And talk about the process and why they headed this way.
Sure. So this is fall under the category as social enterprise. Pete Leonard, the founder of the company, was a technology professional, and he decided to create a company that he felt would give back to the community. It is a for-profit. They are a coffee roaster located about an hour west of Chicago, and he employs almost exclusively people who have come out of incarceration. Interestingly, the one exception to that rule is he has a coffee shop in the local library, and the library would not permit him to have someone with a criminal record staffing inside the library. But it's fabulous custom coffee. It's interesting. Pete takes a scientist and engineer's approach to brewing coffee and roasting coffee, and very scientific and exact about it. So it's perfectly roasted coffee. the person, the roaster of each bag, signs each bag, which I think is great. And it's interesting. It is taking off. It's always been just great coffee in a niche business. But one of the local hospital systems, which has hospitals in Illinois and in Wisconsin, has chosen to make them the key provider because they understand that this is a way of supporting their whole community and community health. And so it's a great example of one that was formed to service this population and support this population.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the sidebar on I Have a Bean also has a sidebar on terminology, which is about what the call people have done time with the system. And it's sort of interesting what you ended up with, finding out what the people at I Have a Bean call each other and themselves.
Right. There is a lot of language that is preferred in this space, and that is good. It should be people-forward language. I hate the fact that someone who had a felony conviction at age 20 is still considered a felon 40 years later. And there's something that just rubs, I think, all of us the wrong way about that. But there's also an awful lot of scolding that goes on. And people will, I've been scolded for saying second chances because a lot of people in this position never had a first chance. I've been scolded for using returning citizens because they've always been citizens. You know, so the message that I try to get across is don't worry too much about language. In the case of Pete Leonard's employees, he gathered them together and said, what do you want to be called? And they all unanimously said, oh, we're felons. Just call us by our first name and treat us respectfully. And I think that is the key here is, don't go around scolding people about language. The people who care, the people you want to reach, will figure it out over time or be very gentle and private in the scolding. The most important thing is let's get this done. Let's offer people opportunities and solve our labor problem at the same time.
All right, so another person who offers some opportunities here, a fellow by the name of Ray Dalton. Talk about his business and his approach to hiring.
So Ray is a serial entrepreneur, one of the most successful business people I've ever met, and he was known. He started something like 7+ companies, and he has always had a contingent of second chance employees. Incidentally, he's best known for a company called PartSource, which was the Amazon of hospital equipment parts. Early on, he learned to have parts instead of sent. He was a parts wholesaler. Instead of sending the parts directly to hospitals, he would have it sent to him. He'd photograph it, put it on the website, and created a web-based catalog and sold it for 8 figures at many years ago. So Ray is very successful, but he also came from a very challenged background, and he appreciated opportunities he was given, in his case by joining the military, and wanted to offer those opportunities to others. So he does has a new company, Relink Medical, that takes, let's say, used X-ray machines, refurbishes them, sells them to say rural hospitals that would not otherwise be able to afford this kind of equipment. Very, very successful. And about a quarter of his workforce is second chance people with records. But he offers a holistic approach in supporting them. He has continuous education. He offers flex time to meet with parole and probation officers. He requires his employees to open bank accounts so they're not counting on check cashing and wasting money that way, and teaches them financial responsibility. He even has classes where he'll take people to restaurants and have an etiquette coach come along to show people how you should conduct a business meeting. So he assumes nothing other than the desire of employees to better themselves, and he holds them to it, but gives them every opportunity to learn and to prosper.
So, Jeff, there are obviously good examples out there, people who have really gone big on second chance hiring. You've certainly made the case in numbers, it seems, but just in the fact of the ongoing labor shortage that we can anticipate going on in the United States if we don't expand the labor availability, the availability of people in the labor market. But now talk about any pressures being applied here. I mean, you talk about shareholders who may want some CSR values in the businesses they support. You know, is the business Business Roundtable, for example, pushing this?
The Business Roundtable is indeed pushing this. Pushing sounds too harsh. They are fully supporting and embracing this. They are a key player in a new organization called the Second Chance Business Coalition. It's being co-chaired by Craig Arnold, the CEO of Eaton Corp, and Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan. And they are going way beyond, say, past pledges of businesses to do fair chance hiring. That didn't work very well. They are committing to actually doing pilot programs and sharing data among the 30-ish large companies that participate. So this is very, very real. These are companies that have goals for their managers and employees and their executives. And so when these are companies that are doing far more than lip service. They're actually getting it done. And I think it's a very exciting development.
I didn't mean to use the acronym without explaining it. CSR, corporate social responsibility, right?
Yes. And this is something that has not really gotten through, I would say, particularly in terms of the diversity, equity, and inclusion focus. It's critical that this be a component of that. The ugly fact of the matter is our criminal justice system has not impacted all communities equally. So currently, one in three black men in America has a felony conviction. So if you have a diversity program that is not being paired with a second chance hiring program and a focus of what's needed to make that happen, your workforce will never reflect the diversity of your population. You are excluding one in three black men among many others.
So you can address a couple of different concerns about diversity, equity, and inclusion by going this route.
Correct.
Jeffrey Korzenek is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. We'll get to some finer detail on what is going on with people hiring people who have been in the criminal justice system and take a phone call or two when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Yes, there are 2-point-something million people in jail and prison in the United States at any given moment, but when you think about people who've had contact with the criminal justice system, by some counts, that could be as high as 70 million Americans. They can't all be considered unemployable for their entire working lives, but they are ruled out categorically by a lot of employers. Jeffrey Korzenek, who works for a large bank as a chief investment strategist, makes the case that yes, indeed, they are employable and should be employed and really need to be to keep the economy growing. He makes the case in the book Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. You're welcome to join the exchange, and I have requested some input from people who might have been through this situation on one side of the transaction or the other. Come in at 800-838-3760 by phone or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a phone call from John in Ashland. Welcome to the exchange.
Hi, thank you. And I appreciate this conversation, Jeffrey.
I'm glad to have you.
My experience is essentially that I suffer from depression and sought medical help. The prescribed medication that was given to me put me into a dark downward spiral, and I tried to commit suicide, and by doing so, I am now a felon. And, you know, I spent 60 days in jail and have been forced out of, you know, my relationship with my partner with a no-contact order. And it was a really difficult process. I've always been mentally sound, but I went through some things in my life that forced me into a sad place. And I just want to say that I thank you both for this conversation, because there are plenty of people that are hardworking individuals and qualified staff and talented people that get into a hole, and more mental health support would really just make a lot of these issues go away in so many ways.
All right, John, thank you so much for sharing that story with us. That was it's impressive that you were willing to let us know about that. And this is Jeffrey Korzenek, I'm sure a story you've heard a bunch of times.
It is, and this is a really wonderful issue to bring up. So thank you, John. And first and foremost, I'm glad you are with us. We have often treated mental health in this country with incarceration, effectively. And this is a great example of how someone is burdened with all the restrictions that are implied by a felony conviction for something that most of us would not say, oh, that should be a felony, or this is a bad person who's unhireable. And this is very typical across the board of what you see. My hope is that once we get employers to truly understand that people who are justice impacted are our future and current workforce, because we have to view them that way, we will start having much better policies surrounding mental health, surrounding the combating the over-incarceration that has gone, combating the overcharging that has gone on. And so I think this is a wonderful example, and I'm grateful to John for sharing it, of how justice involvement is not what we think it is. And we simply can't afford, from a business perspective, let alone an ethical perspective, to waste lives. And we need people, and we need these people, like John, are real resources for our society and for our workforce. We need to be able to find them and support them.
Come back to that point about overcharging, because there are some examples in the book about the different degrees of penalties for certain offenses. I mean, even being in a different city can make a difference in how you are charged.
Absolutely. And John Pfaff, a law professor at Fordham University, has documented a lot of this. We have a long history of overcharging. My personal favorite example is a young woman who is in a workforce development program run by friends of mine in New York. And she's 19 years old. She was out on a date. Fine. She got caught with two fake IDs. In New York State, as a result of post-9/11 anti-terrorism measures, two fake IDs with intent to defraud, in this case, trying to get a drink when you're underage, is a felony. This young woman was charged with a felony. And she would have accepted some kind of plea, guilty plea, had my friend not intervened and got her adequate legal representation. We have educated decades of prosecutors in this country, and some of this is being undone, but the damage is already there, who thought that the route to advancing their career was to get as many felony convictions as possible. And you have people, particularly poor people, who end up being held in pretrial detention. They can't make bail, and will take a plea bargain to just about anything to be able to go home, and without fully realizing what pleading guilty to a felony conviction means for their future.
So they might have actually beaten the charge at trial, but because they wanted to get out of jail, they went ahead and pled.
Correct. Something like 95% or more charges never go to trial. And this is certainly not appropriate due process in light of what our Constitution requires. It's certainly not in the spirit of it. It's quick, it's dirty, but ultimately it ends up doing a lot of harm to people without legal sophistication or high-priced legal support.
Talk then about the kinds of things that are available for people who are incarcerated then. I mean, is there much hope that they'll get anything in the way of education or training and emerge with some particular skills that they can then offer up in the workforce?
This is a real bright spot and something very encouraging. You're starting to see prison systems expand what they provide as state agencies. So some of the highlights, some of the pioneers were in Michigan, where they have three of what are called vocational villages. I visited one myself, a prison in central Michigan, and people there are getting industry-recognized certifications in carpentry and electrical repair and even doing the classwork and simulator work on getting a commercial driver's license. They have a history at these facilities in Michigan, in particular this one, which is somewhat close to Detroit. You walk out of the prison gates and into the union halls and get work. So it's gotten to the point where companies are now approaching these correctional facilities and saying, can you help create a training program for us? So that's a huge win. This is being replicated in states like Kansas, where there's a career campus, and in other states. But you also have higher education stepping up in a big way. This was pioneered by Bard College in New York State. There's the Bard Prison Initiative. It's now several hundred prisons are offering classes and even degree programs in prisons. It's probably not enough. It's hard to scale this to the needs of the prison population, but there's very good progress being made. And then finally, there's also some great work, and this is even the subject of my case study chapter. You see companies stepping up and creating paid training programs within prisons, as well as fairly compensated, I really want to emphasize that, fairly compensated work opportunities or work release opportunities where people can exit the prison for the day to work at a work site and get paid prevailing wages. So all of these things are really important, positive developments.
All right, so then you can emerge certainly with some skills, but then there's an interesting story you tell about an appearance at the Polsky Center in Chicago where you had a group list the tasks then get a job out of prison where the rubber really meets the road, and this is a long list.
Yeah, so this was a fascinating evening spent in Chicago, and it was a moderated discussion that a researcher from Georgetown, and I was there as well, and we were talking to grad students. Very interesting, just the composition of the students who chose to come. It was a voluntary activity. Lots of people from the School of Social Services, someone from the medical school, people from the law school, not a single student from the business school. And that's who we have to reach going forward. But we went through an exercise where we said, okay, someone's coming out of prison, and here they are on this timeline, weeks or months later, applying for a job. What has to happen in between? And you start understanding that people come out of prison are often quite poor, come out with, $100 of gate money, you know, money that's given to them on their release, no clothes, no place to live, no phone, no ID in some cases, or no current ID. They may have lost their driver's license because it couldn't get renewed. And all the, as well as this lack of knowledge, if they were away for 10 or 20 years, as many people are, they may not know how to use the internet or a cell phone or how to apply for a job or have a resume. And what you come to understand is that the person who came out of incarceration, who is standing before you or virtually before you on an internet application site, is someone who's actually overcome great odds to get to that point and is really proof of character and determination. And as one of my friends said to me, who's familiar with this and works in a nonprofit, he said, if people understood what it takes to rebuild your life, they'd view it as a badge, meaning it's something to be admired and respected as a sign of all you have accomplished.
We had a drop-off question from Tim in Oregon. He wouldn't get more specific than that, but he was asking if you've heard of the Delancey Street Foundation, which appears to be a nonprofit in the business of helping people beat addiction. And you do get into the book about nonprofits and an important role they play in getting second-chance people into employment.
Absolutely, and I visited and enjoyed a great meal at their restaurant in San Francisco as well, if that's the one that this gentleman was referring to. The key intermediary here are workforce development and reentry nonprofits. The model that I've seen work, the model that I share in my talks to business owners around the country and, of course, in the book as well, is that you at least to starting out, can't go it alone. You can't figure out in the process of an ordinary job application who's truly ready to turn their life around and who has enough stability to build up a career that, and to have that focus that you need. But the nonprofits who work with these individuals, often over the course of months or even years in providing support, can tell you who's ready. They not just support the individuals, but they can also act, if they're doing this right and if you have the right partnership, they can act as essentially a referral source of who's ready and who's going to be a good fit, and then can help provide some of the follow-on services that these individuals may need.
Is there any central clearinghouse where somebody getting out of prison can tap into a network of employers and nonprofits working together? By the way, I just checked. UntappedTalent.com is available for sale.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I hope none of your listeners snap it up before I do, because it wasn't available when the book came out. There is not. You do have an interesting development, some job boards, 70millionjobs.com, and I've done a lot of work with honestjobs.co. Our job boards, the Indeed.coms for the formerly incarcerated or the Justice Impacted Foundation. And there, at least you find employers who are truly open and committed to hiring from this population. So those are a starting point for some of this, but there aren't great resources. So much of the support that's available is very local. It might be as simple as a local church. It might be national organizations that do this in some locations, like Goodwill Industries. So it's a little bit hard. One of the places to start is there is a network of federally mandated job centers, American Job Centers. CareerOneStop.org is a place you can people can find one of these job centers near them. This is for either applicants, people leaving incarceration, trying to find jobs, or for employers who are trying to find partners as well. So those are our possibilities. It does require legwork, but this legwork on the part of employers should be viewed as an investment, and an investment with a proven high return.
So let's finish up. We have about a minute left or so to talk about, I want to talk about Jeffrey Brown, who addresses several societal concerns at his Brown's Superstores.
Jeff is fantastic. He's one of the most prominent second chance employers in the country. He has a privately owned, family-owned network of grocery stores. He has about 500 of his 2,500 employees are second chance. To help develop them, he's even created his own workforce reentry nonprofits, where he not just trains and gets ready his own future employees, he's even training for competitors. He's just trying to make the city of Philadelphia a better place. What's interesting to me about Jeff and his vision is that he is also visionary in other ways. He's one of the people who inspired First Lady Michelle Obama's nutrition campaigns. He sat next to her at one of the State of the Union speeches. He also is the grocer to the food deserts of North Philadelphia. He has grocery stores, modern, nice grocery stores, in places people have historically said you couldn't have good grocery stores. So this is part of being a great company and a great business leader. Second chance business leaders are also just great business people.
All right. There's a lot to be said about the points that Jeffrey Korzenek makes in his book, Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.